When you think about memories of enjoying jazz in Cincinnati, where does your mind take you? To the Blue Wisp Jazz Club or Schwartz's Point? The early days of the Ohio Valley Jazz Festival or all the way back to the Cincinnati Cotton Club? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the history of jazz in Cincinnati are local musicians Melvin Broach, Kathy Wade, and Yemi Oyedarin. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, yes.
Melvin, when you think about jazz and the cities that really stand out, where does Cincinnati fit into the mix?
It was sort of like a mecca, sort of like New York or Chicago or St. Louis, because it was the gateway to the South and the North. And a lot of the jazz musicians that came from New Orleans, St. Louis, Kansas City, that were going to Detroit, Chicago, places like that. This was like a first stop or like a jump off point or a jump on point going to points north or south because of the Union Terminal down in the West End.
Okay. So yes. A big deal.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, how does Cincinnati's jazz scene now compare to other cities?
So I've spent a lot of time visiting a lot of other towns, and I usually like to stop at jam sessions. And just about every town I go to, with maybe the exception of Chicago or New York, I'm always disappointed. The musicianship level here in Cincinnati is above and beyond just about every other city. And it's something that's hard to believe. And it wasn't until I started going to other jam sessions in other cities that I started realizing that we have something really, really incredibly special here. We have an amazing jam session here on Monday nights that's over at the Lounge in Northside. You really get to see the excellence that's in this city. We're really spoiled in Cincinnati and don't realize it, that we have an incredible legendary vocalist, Miss Wade here, and we have Mr. Broach, who is one of the best drummers in the country, you know, and it's something that we don't recognize very often, that we have such astounding talent from every level of jazz in Cincinnati.
Well, we're very lucky to have them in the studio today, that's for sure. Kathy, would you agree with that? I mean, do you think Cincinnati is doing pretty well when it comes to the jazz scene currently?
I do. One, from the performance perspective, and two, from the promoter booking perspective, absolutely. There's a plethora of talent to choose from, and it's getting younger and younger. I just recently did a gig with a 15-year-old phenom on the bass by the name of Cadence Okowobi. She is a junior at Walnut Hills.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were just at the Springfield Jazz and Blues Festival on Saturday, and the gentleman who produces that, who's the Director of Education for Jazz Live at Lincoln Center, to which she had just returned from their jazz camp, second year in a row she's been there. First year she was there, my producing partner, Laura Gentry, got a phone call from her best friend, Tim Warfield, who was teaching at the camp, and said, "Do you know this young lady from Cincinnati?" And she said, "Of course I know this lady from Cincinnati." I mean, who wouldn't? They are blown away. And I can actually see why. I've never performed with a 15-year-old before, but we had a blast. Melvin was on the gig. Julie Spangler was on piano from the CSO Pops. It was amazing. So I say all that to simply say that, yes, Cincinnati definitely has the vibe, the talent. I always wish for more outlets. That's the thing that I feel is missing. Because it's important to either create the venue, create the opportunity so that the world can hear what we have here.
Well, Kathy, when you think of the history of Cincinnati jazz, you know, I mentioned some venues at the top of this conversation. What are the clubs that really stand out to you the most?
I just feel like if we had more, I mean, I spent what started out when the late Ed Moss was still with us, when he opened up his space, The Point, I can remember I was only going to stay a month, and I ended up staying a year, which gave me a full year of, as they say, shedding, because Ed Moss did not play. He tightened everything up in me, trust me, in terms of vocal and listening and hearing and finding and understanding.
About that lady on my telephone, are you be eating a TV dinner? I'll be gone.
If there were just... You know, having that opportunity to do that is so important. So if there were more venues, Cafe Vivace is really making noise now. I listen to the Real Jazz station on Sirius FM. And just the other day, they were saying, we're going to play the next song is by so-and-so. And oh, by the way, you can catch him at Cafe Vivace in Cincinnati. I'm sitting in my car going, yeah, you know, that's us. So, you know, we had the Bluest for a very long time. The Blue West Big Band now, of course, plays on Wednesdays at Cafe Vivace. I just think there could be more venues. I do miss the Greenwich. I do miss the music room at the Greenwich. So
you mentioned Ed Moss. Share some memories about Ed with us.
Everybody has an Ed Moss story.
I think what I appreciated about Ed the most was understanding. I've been really fortunate to work with some really good pianists. Ed Moss and Bill Cunliffe both gave me lessons in always sing the melody. The reason why a song becomes a standard is because everybody can sing along. That's true in no matter what the genre of the music is. But for jazz, when you're dealing with the Great American Songbook, people want to believe they're sounding as good as you, and that's fine. So the whole idea is
even though you know it's not true.
Yeah, of course, of course. But the whole idea is to lay that melody down so that you've established the story. And then add your part or your version of the story behind it. I think Melvin and both Yemi can probably speak to that as well in terms of that's what improv is all about, the improvisation of jazz. It's putting, you know, your spin on it, but never forgetting that it was already it before you got it.
Melvin, you have any Ed Moss stories you want to share? There were a lot of chuckles when I asked that question.
Ed Moss. I think I met Ed when I was maybe about 17 years old. I was in high school, and I was playing in Avondale at a real prominent jazz club called Duncan's Lounge. Mm-hmm. And that's where you saw all your black dignitaries, your teachers, your lawyers, and everything. And actually, I really wasn't supposed to be in there. I said I was like 17, but I was like 16, but I had a little eyebrow pencil on my mustache. So. and I was playing the gig there. And after the gig, we would go to Clifton on Macmillan and... Mm-hmm. He had a place called the Golden Triangle.
Oh, yes, the Golden Triangle.
Yeah. The Golden Triangle. And I was in high school, and I would go. We would go in after our gig, and our gig was over like 2 o'clock. And we said, "Well, let's go up to Ed Moss's place." Now, go up to Ed Moss, and he would have fantastic band. He'd have Bob Bodley, Lou Lousy, Ed Moss, Grover Mooney, and those guys would be jamming. None of those guys knew me. I was young. The only one knew me was Grover Mooney because he knew I was a drummer. He heard me play before. So I would go up there and listen to him, and I learned a lot of stuff that I really didn't know. You know, they didn't sell food, but they sold, like, poppy seed cake and this thing called espresso and this other little drink called cappuccino, which I didn't know what it was. So you want some? Sure, give me a little cup of that, a little cup of that. I didn't know that I was going to be awake for 8 days after I drank this stuff.
How was your drumming after that?
Oh, man. They called me up on the stage. I didn't want to come down. Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool. And I kind of liked Ed because he reminded me of my younger days when I listened to my older brothers. They were from the 40s, 30s and 40s. And those guys, they played with guys like Monk, Charlie Parker, those guys, my older brothers. So when I heard him, I said, yeah, he's kind of doing a lot of Bud Powell type stuff. And I said, okay, but that's bebop, and that's their generation. I'm from this generation. I think we're a little hipper.
Yeah, I mean, Melvin just mentioned some legendary names there. Who were the people that you were really inspired by, you were really influenced by when you were getting into jazz?
My first moment was checking out a Miles Davis Kind of Blue. I was at my parents' dinner party, and I brought home from school, I went to boarding school, and I brought home from school a whole bunch of these records that the librarian was like, you have to listen to these. And I put on Kind of Blue in the middle of, like, we're a Nigerian family, so we're listening to, like, High Life and Things Are Moving. And then all of a sudden I drop this Miles Davis record, and everything like chills out for a second. And I thought that I ruined the vibe. So like I quickly paused it, and my uncle's head whipped around and was like, "Did you just turn off Miles Davis?" And like everybody in the room was like, "What are you doing? How dare you?" And from that moment, I was like, okay, so this might be into something. So I listened to Kind of Blue, I think, every day for like years after that. And that kind of was my entry into the art form.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you all think about the first time you saw a big jazz act locally, I'll start with you, Kathy. Who was it and what kind of impression did that performance
Amanda Ambrose. My mother loved Amanda Ambrose. Do you guys remember her? She was a wonderful singer, moved to Canada. I remember that. But, you know, listening to Yemi, I get this. Both my parents were jazz aficionados. So on my father's day off, I heard all instrumentalists. On my mother's day off, I heard all vocalists. Mm. So I got the best of both worlds. And I understood not to mess up the needle on the turntable. Don't rub it. Don't do anything. So I could pull out the albums that my father played on his off days, that the songs that I liked. And that was everybody, you know. I mean, at Miles, oh goodness, saxophone players. I can remember Zoot. I remember the first time I heard Zoot Sims. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, for me, it was having that education. And then also being surrounded with Motown at the same time. And then when I discovered I had a voice, and people discovered I had a voice, oh, you should sing. So no. Is that Nina you're talking about? I love Aretha Franklin, but I want Nina. I can remember my first voice lesson in college. I was at Edgecliffe. I had a great voice teacher. And she said to me, "You could be the next Leontine Price." I said, no. Billie Holiday. Let's get that straight.
Well, we are talking in this recorded interview about the history of jazz in Cincinnati. What about you, Melvin? I mean, you grew up surrounded by music.
Yes.
You had older brothers who played with legendary jazz musicians. What made the biggest impression on you early on?
The fact that I am an original Lincoln Cordian.
Wow. Love it.
That's a big deal.
It is.
Yes. My mom moved into the Lincoln Course in 1941. They didn't officially open till 1942. So I was born there, and I was lucky to be born in between five top jazz clubs in the West End. I lived directly across the street from a club called The Grand. Directly. It was on the side of Jameson Funeral Home. Mm. On Hopkins and John. On the next corner was called The Rendezvous. That was on Hopkins and Central. On this corner here was Central and Clark, was an Afro-Cuban dance studio. Me living right across the street, which I was always told, you know, you're 5 years old, you can't go across the street by yourself. Yeah, but you can't keep watching me. You know, I see guys pulling up with basses, drums, horns. I was like, no, I'm going over there and see.
Well, you know? When you were just 5 years old.
Yeah, I would cross over the streetcar tracks, you know, because we had streetcar tracks run down, John. And I would cross over the streetcar tracks, and I would just listen to, oh, man, I listened to Dinah Washington. Mm. Yeah, she gave my first kiss.
was that at five?
Yeah, that's right on the jaw, kiss. Yeah.
That counts, right on the jaw.
And I would hear the band playing. And I knew my brothers would always be over there playing with their bands, with Edison Gore, Art Gore's mm-hmm. uncle, who taught mm-hmm. them. And I hear those guys over there with the Modern Jazz Disciples. Mm-hmm. But the reason I met so many is because, like I said, we live right across the street. We were so close to the jazz clubs when the people would come in town. When they needed to rehearse, we were right there.
Great location.
There were drum sets, basses, pianos, organ. Everybody would rehearse right there in that big room we had. And we had the windows open. It was on the first floor, so all the kids could climb up in the window, and everybody could, they went by on the bus stop or whatever. And we were always jamming. So Jamal Howard, the organ player, would set me on his knee, they would play something like How High the Moon. I remember that tune. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I would start swinging. Mm-hmm. And then everybody would say, oh, Miss Brooks, your baby's back here. That, who is that on drum? That's Melvin. No, it's not. They came back. You know, I was about this tall, and the sticks were about that long.
The sticks as long as your legs?
Yeah. Yeah. But I was swinging.
I know you were.
And from then on, all the guys that was there, Curtis Pegler, Hickey Kelly, all of those guys, Snooky Gibson, all of those guys, when they come to rehearse, right at the end of their rehearsal, they would let me play.
Well, you know, we were talking about what a big deal Cincinnati was at this crossroads for jazz. What about WLW? I mean, how big a role did that play? Do you have thoughts on that, Yemi? Because I understand Fats Waller was a house musician, I think, in the 30s.
Can I just add a little something?
Yeah.
Fats Waller actually went to the dentist above, which is where the Point is located. That was a dentist's office on the second floor. In fact, if you ever went up there when Ed was still living and had the apartment open, you can see the cubicles.
Oh, my goodness.
Where the patients would go. But the Point, the club, the Point, it is really a point up on the second floor altogether. So
yeah. That's Schwartz's Point now,
Schwartz's
right?
Point, yeah. I would definitely say that's the first thing that comes to mind about WLW because Fats Waller did play there. And was exposed across the world because they had the highest wattage in terms of
giant reach.
Right, exactly.
So Fats Waller lived in Cincinnati from 1932 to 1934, and he had a show on WLW that was Fats Waller's, I have it in my notes, Fats Waller's Rhythm Club. And that's kind of the first time that Midwesterners got an exposure to jazz. A lot of people didn't know that WLW transmitted at 500,000 watts, which is insane. I mean, it had an astounding reach. This is why the big one. You know, this is why you had King Records. This is why you had all of the musical activity that's happening. All of these great musicians are coming to town. They're all here because of WLW. This was the most prestige job to have as a musician in America at the time. And because of that, you know, Fats Waller is able to get on the airwaves and is able to disseminate jazz to the Midwest. And that's kind of really the beginning of it for a lot of people in the 30s.
Do you think that helped keep Cincinnati on the map, that WLW?
Oh, I would think so.
It definitely put Cincinnati on the map. There are other things that kind of helped in the process. So in the 1920s, a man by the name of Artie Matthews starts the Cosmopolitan School of Jazz. Mm-hmm. And that, because at the time, you know, African Americans weren't able to attend the Conservatory of Music. Mm-hmm. And there had to be some sort of response to that. So this school that's kind of created comes out of that. I believe the piano player, Frank Foster studied there as well, as did Ezra Charles. Ezra Charles, who played bass, also studied there.
Yes.
But that combined with CCM and CCM's jazz program, which began in the 70s, really helped keep that same energy. Because after WLW left, all the musicians left with it. You know, all the country musicians moved to Nashville, and that's the start of Nashville. It starts after WLW stops having live talent on air. But Cincinnati's able to keep this tradition around because we had this educational system, this pipeline. And the Cosmopolitan School of Music really started the pipeline for African-American musicians, which later flows into SCPA. The SCPA, after Cosmopolitan leaves, SCPA eventually kind of picks up some of that training of the talent in Cincinnati.
Well, Kathy and Melvin, I know you both have done your fair share of training of the talent in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For me, it's another level and a different culture that from what he's doing. The way I got it and the guys in my era around my age got it, we got all the education and exposure from jazz jam sessions. They were popular everywhere. And I started going to jam sessions, the real sessions where I would met a lot of the really guys. These guys weren't college guys. The jam sessions, you met everybody on the jam sessions, from Rosson, Roland Kirk to Herbie Hand, all those guys were on jam sessions. And where did jam sessions had to stop? I think the union stopped the jam sessions. But when they did that, we weren't able to share ideas and give each other some advice and share ideas, because a lot of us we couldn't afford college. Matter of fact, we said, well, I don't need to go to college. This is up here. With several on paper, you got to look at that. Paper can tell you what to play, but paper can't tell you what to feel. So we got it here, and we got it from each other. So we were just doing our thing, and everybody came. Yeah. They knew where the sessions were. Everybody came. Some of the greats, and Francine Griffin, Dakota State, and Gloria Lynn, I can think of, Sadie Burch, all of those were at the jam session. All the horn players, Ronnie Kirk, changed his name to Rossine Roland Kirk, all those guys, all the musicians went to the jam sessions. That was our schooling, and that was how we connected, and that was how we shared information and what gigs were open and who to talk to and where we could play. That came from that. Most of the stuff that we did didn't come from school.
I was fortunate enough to meet Melvin at the jam sessions when they kind of began in the 90s again. And as we were getting ready for this, I was realizing that I met Melvin when I was 19 at a jam session at the Greenwich. Too young to enter, but, we'll bypass that.
You were 14 years older than Melvin was.
But I the jam session is and still is a crucial element of learning how to play. Yes. I remember I'd played like St. Thomas. And I tried to do what I did was a mess. It did not work out. And I get off the drums and Melvin pulls me aside to the bar and is like, there's only one way that you play St. Thomas. And it's like this. the tradition continues. Stacy Dillard, when he was in town,
Yes.
The great, say he's now great, very well-known sax sax player. There are all these people, Brian Newman,
William Minifield, all of those guys.
Mm-hmm. All these, this younger generation of musicians that continued that tradition of sitting under younger players and getting told when you sounded bad and come back next week and we'll see how you work this week. Mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful experience learning that way.
Yeah.
Well, now, Kathy, we didn't ask Melvin or Yemi to bring their drums, but you did bring your voice. So I don't know if you'd care to give us a little demonstration,
Lord,
before we have to wrap this up, but we
goodness.
Would certainly appreciate it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. There will be many other nights like this, and I'll be standing here with someone new. There will be other songs to sing, another fall, another spring. There will never be another you.
Dang, I don't think we can do any better than that.
There'll never be another you, Miss Kathy.
Thank you. Well, I've been talking with jazz drummer Melvin Broach, jazz vocalist Kathy Wade, and jazz drummer Yemi Oyedarin. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum and Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.
I'll be the pencil on your motor, baby. I'll be the icing on your cake. I'll be the butterball on your table, honey. If you can dish it out, I can drag it. 'Cause you're